What are we doing here?
A groove house was humming, just so I decided to go with it.
Oh, the humming groove. All right, welcome to Technology Bites.
He's not showing his online.
You know, maybe. Nah, never mind. Welcome to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Dwight.
Ow. Hello?
I killed him. I killed him.
You killed the groove house.
He's killed groove
bleeding
house.
Out of one of his ears.
Well, I don't think my mic works.
That's all right. Flicked hasn't got anything working right tonight. So that's good.
Hello?
Hello? Testing? Are we reaching?
You are.
Awesome. All right, let's try that again. Welcome to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Dwight.
And he's
Groove House.
You are kind of quiet. I heard you.
It's barely working.
Yeah, something sounds weird.
You're quiet as well.
Yeah, something sounds really weird.
He sounds small.
Barrett sounded like a blown out speaker.
Yeah, my mic sounds really hot in my ears.
Yeah.
Whoa, Dwight's in my head.
Yeah.
Whoa. Yeah, Dwight's pretty loud.
Yeah.
Dwight's doing the full Barry White.
Yeah, baby.
Oh, no. Save us all. All right, so we're, you know, surprisingly, we have technical issues. Who the guest? Well, welcome back to Houston, Barrett.
Thank you.
I saw that you were suffering through the dry Good Friday in Ireland.
Yeah, that now I can't hear myself on my own. Surely we're still going.
Yeah
no one told me that. I had concerns that they would not sell, not necessarily not sell alcohol, but no pubs would be open on Easter Sunday. So I Googled and pubs were open Easter Sunday. So I thought I'm in the clear.
But
nope, not on Good Friday. They call it Dry Friday, which, you know, I found out all too late. Even the grocery stores don't sell anything. The weird thing is it's not enforced by law. It's just what they do in the Republic of Ireland. So the hackerspace there threw a beer party like a kegger with barbecue. So beer was had.
So you circumvented their strange non-drinking customs.
Non-drinking, non-meat-eating.
All right, well, I'm not liking this sound. It just sounds terrible. So, okay.
It's not normal. Something's not right.
Yeah, I don't know.
I blame Saeed and the Arab voices.
Amy Goodman?
Amy Goodman might have also messed it up.
Oh, she is calling.
Wow, that was really quick. Her people are like fast.
That's right. They're on it.
You got to police your brand on the internet.
Wow.
All right. Well, we're glad you could tune in, and we hope that it's a better listening experience out there than it is here in the headphones. I feel like I got a big head cold. Sounds.
The teacher on Charlie Brown.
All right. So go ahead, Pete.
If the feed that I'm getting to my side is more like what's going out, you guys sound fine now. At first it was off, but
okay.
Right now everybody sounds pretty normal.
I mean, you know, using that term loosely. All right, so check us out online at geekradio.com. You can visit our webpage there, guaranteed not to be hacked by Russian spamminists. And apparently something happened to the KPFT site. I only saw a moderate amount of stuff about it, but the site's getting pushed over. Are you involved with the new site, Pete?
I thought I was supposed to be, but now I saw an announcement they were releasing something new, and I've not been involved with that. So.
I think they had to quickly release something new because the old one was compromised in some regard.
Yeah, I don't know if that's... I don't know. I'm not sure. I was asking him, and I did see it redirected, and he said it was an HT access, so I'm not sure if it was...
The server or the website.
Or if it was intentional, or if it was... I don't know why they would do that, but...
Hmm. All right, so you can visit our website, which will take you to our website. Only. And it hasn't been revamped in years, so it looks exactly as you remember it.
Hackers won't touch it.
No. They have, you know, principles. We're not going to lower ourselves quite that low. That webpage already looked hacked.
Someone got to it first.
Somebody beat us to it. Look at that guy. What's that? All right, so also hang out with us, IRC, irc.cuckoo.com.
Cuckoo.
In Pound Tech Bites, that is the place to be. And Also, you can contact us via the website. There's a contact form there if you don't want to call in and you want to send us your questions via the webpage. We can try to take those on air as time allows. And the phone number, which you'll need a little bit later on, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. And all that's out of the way. We're going to hand it over to Technology Bites roaming correspondent Peter Hughes with the Technology Bites InfoShot. Take it away, InfoShot.
It's the Technology Bites InfoShot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
Well, Apple's on a continued roll. Oops, this one's not a good one, though. 16 states have joined the U.S. Department of Justice in suing Apple and a number of publishers over allegedly colluding to fix ebook prices. Oops. Connecticut Attorney General George Jepson made the announcement on Wednesday afternoon. That was this afternoon, just hours after the Department of Justice filed its antitrust suit in New York, saying that Apple, Macmillan, Penguin, and Simon & Schuster engaged in, quote, anti-competitive price fixing scheme, unquote, when selling ebooks through Apple's iBookstore. Jepson said, publishers deserve to make money, but consumers deserve the price benefits of competition in an open and unrestricted marketplace. Those interests clearly collided in this case, and we're going to work to ensure the ebook market is open once again to fair competition. Yes, remember those golden days when the ebook market was all competitive? I don't either. The effort's being led by Connecticut and Texas, with Alaska, Arizona, Colorado, Illinois, Iowa, Maryland, Missouri, Ohio, Oregon, Pennsylvania, South Dakota, Tennessee, Vermont, West Virginia, and even Puerto Rico. Yeah, man, from Puerto Rico, joining the ranks. The states aren't targeting all of the publishers originally accused of plotting with Apple, though. Apparently, HarperCollins and Hachette have already come to an agreement with the states that they will provide restitution to consumers using a formula based on the number of states participating and the number of ebooks sold in each state. Wow, that formula sounds like where the states get the money and you still paid too much for an ebook, but maybe that's just me. The specific details of that settlement have yet to be worked out, according to Jepson, but will be finalized in the coming weeks. So that one's on the plus side, obviously, for such a new market as ebooks, it's good to see that they're paying attention to make sure that the prices are not out of line with what they should be, hopefully. And in PC sales, that the numbers just came out for the first quarter. And, of course, if you'd ask anybody to predict, like, say, Gartner, their prediction, they're on the record, so we know what they predicted, that PC sales would fall by 1.2%. But apparently, no, PC sales were strong, not really. They grew by almost 2% in the first quarter of 2012, which makes Gartner wrong, but is not great. Of course, part of why they grew 2% compared to the previous year is because last year was the second worst year for sales in the history of the PC industry, except at Apple, which turned in its best year for Mac sales ever. Hey, so the idea is, has the PC sales, have they bounced off bottom? You know, in other words, did they hit their bottom and go, and now it's up 2% growth? Although it's not clear if that's what's happening. The main reason it happened is that Europe and the Middle East bought more computers. They grew by 7%. Asia was below expectations, and emerging markets slowed down generally. Apparently, the hard drive problem, the supply problem from the floods in Thailand, didn't cause as many problems as some had expected. You know, there were issues around Christmas last year, if you remember. Apparently, there was a moderate impact on select markets, like low-end consumer notebooks, but the demand was so low that the tight hard drive supply was not quite such a problem. The interesting thing, from a growth perspective, Lenovo grew the most, boosting its shipments by more than 28%, and that was particularly in, like, Europe. Dell underperformed and saw declines. Their growth went down. Then in the U.S., who's number one? Ooh, we're all so competitive with our computer brands, right? Yeah, whatever. Hewlett Packard is number one with about 29% of the market. Dell is second with 22.3%, and their growth was minus 3.6% year over year. Apple is third with 10.6%. And then this is where the numbers get sort of interesting. Acer is fourth as far as brands go in sales. They dropped almost 26%. They sold almost a quarter fewer computers than they did last year for the same period of time. And Toshiba was down almost 20%. It's like, whoa. So the overall market went down by 3.5%. And everybody but Dell and everybody but, I'm sorry, HP and Apple shrank. So that's not particularly a bounce, at least not in the United States. Obviously, Apple's still happy. They made a ton of money with their 10% of the market. And I guess HP can be happy on being number one, but everybody else had reasons to be not happy. Toshiba, maybe they can turn it around with their 13-inch tablet. They announced the 13-inch Excite tablet yesterday, and the company made an argument that one size does not fit all when it comes to touchscreen devices. The real question with this one is who will use such a large slab of mobile computing? You know, think about if you've got an iPad or you've been around one. 13 inches is like the screen is 13 inches, is 3 inches larger across the diagonal. So that's it's like holding the upper piece of a 13-inch laptop, which that's a pretty much bigger. According to Jared Levitt, a Toshiba spokesperson, when he told Wired that the larger size makes it an ideal kitchen tablet. So, of course, you know, in case you've been wanting to buy a tablet specifically for your kitchen, now there finally is one. I want to see the commercial for that. They need to hire the people who do the, like, infomercial commercials. You know, the ones where the problem is just so difficult to solve. Like, it's so hard putting trash bags into your garbage can. And the person just fails at it. They're totally inept. And then you use a new product and it all works great. Anyways, the Excite 13 runs on Google's Android 4.0 operating system. And you know what? It's sort of sad that when you hear whatever the number, you know, Android 4.0 operating system, I don't know which one that is. Is that Ice Cream Sandwich? I don't know. If they don't give the, like, code name, then that's the way that I've learned, and I think most geeks have kind of learned the branding on Google's Android system, and so I think they might take a marketing lesson there. Despite being bigger than pretty much every other competing tablet on the market, it's actually not that thick or heavy, relatively speaking, noting that it weighs 2.2 pounds and measures 0.4 inches thick. So it's less than half an inch thick. But, you know, most of the direction is towards smaller. You know, the first tablet that got any traction after Apple is the 7-inch Kindle Fire. The Apple's, you know, 10-inch. The rumors are focused on an iPad mini and a 7-inch tablet. Not clear if people want or need a 13-inch tablet. So time will tell. The thing is, it sits at the top of a revamped tablet line for Toshiba in terms of both price and screen size. It has a price tag of $650 for the 32 gig model and $750 for the 64 gig. So price wise, it's falling in the kind of iPad range with a bigger screen. So perhaps that will, perhaps that'll give them a chance. There's also, for those looking for a more traditionally sized tablet that still packs a quad core processor punch, they've got in June there'll be a 7.7 inch version of the Excite for about $500 for a 16 gig. And then there'll be a 10-inch in May. So, you know, this replaces Toshiba's old line of Thrive slates, which were offered in 7 and 10 inch sizes. The other interesting thing, the 10 inch Excite 10 will be $450 for the 16 gig. If you're paying attention, the 7.7 inch version is $500 for a 16 gig. And in case you're wondering why the Excite 7 is more expensive than the Excite 10, the spokesperson explained, smaller is harder to do. So I'm waiting for the 27-inch tablet to come out from some clever manufacturer who lost 20-some-odd percent of their market share over the year. You heard about the whole Google Glass thing, and there was plenty of stories on it. I don't think we have to go into huge. We mentioned it. Obviously none of us work for Google. Google's not rushing out to hand us, glasses or any of that stuff. And so they're getting a lot of attention, but there are apparently 6 pairs of glasses, 6 brands of glasses that have integrated displays that you can buy today. A company called Vuzix released its first pair of augmented reality glasses, the Eyewear VR 920, in 2009, which had 2 LCD displays that mimic a 62-inch screen that sits 9 feet away. So that's like a big screen TV in your glasses. An add-on camera routes real-time footage of the real world to the LCDs, so you get augmented reality elements on top of being able to still see what's in front of you. The Vuzix glasses were perhaps the first low-cost integrated display glasses on the market that didn't outright suck. Apparently that distinction is not translated into mass market appeal and sales. Same for the Sony Glasstron personal video headset. It was released in 1997. Or maybe some of you remember the 3D monochromatic Virtual Boy from Nintendo, which couldn't get people into it. But here's the ones that are the real ones. There's Recon Mod Live Alpine Goggles, which is the brand is Recon, and essentially they give you they use brighter GPS location display, elevation, speed, and time of day in a small screen at the bottom right of your field of vision. That's sort of, unless you're a skier, I don't know that that's a big deal. Vuzix has their Star 1200 augmented reality glasses are $5,000. And if you look at them, they're very, you would look very cybernetic wearing them. You'd look very odd, I think, maybe wearing them. I don't think anybody would look cool with them. Then they look, because they've got the screens cover where your eyes go. And then there's a bar across the front of where, on a pair of sunglasses, the shades for your eyes would be, that has the camera in it. And then it, so it just looks kind of, I don't know, it's got kind of a Tommy vibe to me. Then there's the Brother Air Scouter, which gives you that sort of cyborg, and Brother, the printer company, has their device. It's got the pair of glasses, and then it's got the real cool cyborg on one side, the kind of lump with the arm that sticks out in front of your left eye, and gives you the equivalent of looking at a 16-inch monitor that's a meter away. Apparently, this is used a lot for factory workers so that there's instructions or information while they're working on stuff in real time. They don't say what the price is, but apparently also it's like tied to a particular system that you've got to have. These aren't ones you just like buy and hook up to your iPhone. Epson has one. All the printer companies are making these things. And their idea is to replace the display on your desk or the TV in your living room with it. The Epson Movirio BT100 supposedly recreates the viewing area of an 80-inch monitor sitting 16.4 feet away. It seems like that's kind of far. I guess that's how far you're supposed to sit away from an 80-inch monitor, but it sure kind of means that it seems like it'll be smaller than you expect. And then finally, Sony has an $800 HMZT1, which is for entertainment. Apparently, according to the devices, it succeeds. It mimics a 750-inch screen that's 65 feet away. At some point, doesn't the math turn into where a 750-inch screen that's 65 feet away is like a I don't know, 200-inch screen that's, you know, 30 feet away? Or it just seems like some of this starts getting... I've never watched TV from 65 feet away. I guess that's supposed to be like a movie theater screen. All of them are nearly $1,000 or up to $5,000. So hopefully Google, I'm guessing, is this another one of those deals where all these other companies have been doing this for years and it doesn't work and nobody wants it? And then either someone like Google or someone like Apple comes in and makes it a winner. I think the field sure seems to be wide open, because I don't think anybody's... I don't know. As I look at the various options, if you want to go to Wired.com, you can see these. None of them really look that appealing to me, especially then when you see the price. It's kind of like, maybe not. I don't think so. I can do other things with that money. Now on to... There's a couple of... These are more interesting things that are partners to your tablet or phone. Here's one, just in case you're either that cheap or you have to fool yourself so that you'll really work if you have your iPad with you. And this one's sort of a surprise that it hadn't been knocked off sooner. Somebody's come out with a case that's got a keyboard that makes your iPad look exactly like a MacBook Pro, complete with brushed aluminum-like finish and black chiclet keyboard. It also has a lithium power battery for extra juice to your touchscreen. It has USB and it has a USB and mini USB port, again along with the battery. It doesn't have the cool backlit MacBook Pro keyboard, and it connects to the iPad via Bluetooth. One of the ways, this one, it looks so much like a power MacBook Pro that, you would think they might get like a cease and desist letter from Apple, but apparently the trick is they didn't try to put the Apple logo on the back of it. They just put a hole in the back of the case part that holds the iPad so that the Apple logo that's on the iPad shows through it. Right now it's only available in Japan, but I would bet it'd be coming here. Now, so you just wonder, would that make it less apt to be stolen if somebody thought it was a MacBook Pro versus it being an iPad, or less likely? I don't know. But I talked about the headsets and how they are a thing that has not quite gotten to cool yet, and nobody's got a really good one. Another thing that hasn't really caught on is smartwatches. But according to Gadget Lab at Wired, that might change with Alerta's new wrist-worn creation. It's called Pebble, and it's an e-ink smartwatch. And here's the part where it gets sort of smart. It connects to iOS, so Apple stuff, and Android devices. It's available today for pre-order on Kickstarter for $115. It's basically, it's kind of a... It looks like a black watch, black plastic watch with a band on it. With a 144x168 black and white e-ink display. It also has a vibrating motor, 4 buttons, a 3-axis accelerometer, and Bluetooth 2.1 plus EDR, which facilitates wireless connection to Android or iOS devices. The thing is, it looks fairly slick. It does more than show the time, obviously. Once it's connected to your phone, the watch can display incoming caller IDs, notify you when you get an email, provide weather and calendar alerts, and more. Android users can even view SMS messages on the watch. Apparently, this data is not available from iOS. All of the notification settings, along with various watch face options, are customizable via the mobile app. It also comes with a few built-in apps of its own. It uses the GPS on a connected smartphone for itself to allow cyclists runners to see speed, distance, pace data, and that on the watch. It's got a music app that makes it possible to control songs playing on your smartphone, a golf app that supports more than 25,000 courses and lets golfers see their distance from the green. This one is hackable. You can access Pebble's Open SDK to create more apps and notifications. For the ones who don't know how to code, there is a web-facing endpoint as well, so that you can set up, you know, simple alerts for yourself. Now, why would you want a smartwatch for these tasks instead of just pulling out your phone? Well, according to their spokesperson, you know, maybe you're running the bus or juggling multiple bags. A lot of times it's easier to just look at your wrist, and it's a much more discreet way for checking your phone. I must say I'd agree with that one. You know, in a meeting, if you're looking at your phone, that goes over a lot less well than, of course, you still have to be careful looking at your wrist, at your wristwatch, because that still does the, like, you know, is this meeting over yet thing. It comes in three colors, the Pebble, red, white, and black, and will work with an iPhone or iPod Touch running iOS 5 and Android devices running OS 2.3 or later. The battery lasts for about 7 days, and the Pebble can stay connected to your device at distances up to 20 feet. So even if your phone's not in your pocket, you can get notifications. They've already sold like 1,200 of these via Kickstarter, and it's scheduled to ship in September this year, and when it goes to retail, it'll be about $150. So this one, actually, I must say, this smartwatch, you know, we've reported on a few. I think there was a one that was sort of Windows oriented, and there was, I think, Motorola had something, and they didn't really seem to get it, where this one does seem more potentially useful. And that's the news.
All right. Thanks for the news.
Plenty of new stuff this time.
So do we think, I didn't pay attention to the whole news, so I don't know if you mentioned this, but do you have any thoughts on iPhone 5 or the new iPhone or iPhone June or October, July or October?
I would think Apple, they spent a lot of effort, you know, I guess it depends. If Apple planned to move the phone to the fall to kind of spread out the release dates on stuff, then I would think they'll stick with it. You know, I think whatever time they do it this year is whatever the regular time that Apple wants to be releasing. And I think they probably want to leave themselves more time, not less. So if I was going to guess, I would guess that they'll do the fall. Cause it certainly didn't seem to hurt sales for being in the fall versus being in, I guess, the earlier ones were June.
There's also the issue of wanting to line up with people's contract and when it expires. So for now, it would make sense. You know, they could do it either one, but a year from now, if they have made this, you know, the 4S, people's contracts will be up 2 years in the end of in October of next year. So they probably will want to keep on that cycle going forward, I suspect.
I didn't think about the contract aspect.
Yeah. Because it's all for 2 years, so.
Okay. So, October. I mean, it's all guesswork anyway. We don't know for sure.
They could announce it tomorrow.
I don't think that'll happen.
They
could,
though.
Much say that won't happen.
Yeah, but sometime between June and
sometime between June and October.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, apparently the, you know, oddly enough, the iPhone 4S is still selling very strongly right now. You know, you'd think that they would that it would start to maybe tail off, especially if people were thinking about the next one. But no, apparently it's turned into where the demand has stayed pretty steady.
I think the techies and the gadget freaks fixate on the next one. I think other people, you know, normals say, oh, I need a phone.
I'm not fixating on the next one because I'm a techie or a geek. I'm fixating on the next one because I'm actually thinking about buying in now.
Right, right. You don't have a...
Right. Right.
But at heart, you're a techie and a geek.
So. Yeah, but that's not what drives it. I mean, I've had the same Android phone now for almost 2 years, and I'm ready for a new phone. So looking at my options. My contract is up in... If they're worried about contracts being up, my contract's up in July, so...
I don't know how T-Mobile's works, AT&T, after about 20 months or so, even though you're in a 24-month contract, you can then upgrade.
And so, oh, yeah, you can upgrade. I don't want to upgrade. I'm leaving, probably leaving T-Mobile.
T-Mobile, yeah. Yeah, I may switch to Verizon. And possibly Sprint, depending on the way things shake out. If Sprint has LTE in Houston by the time there's a new iPhone and it's an LTE-based iPhone and it's Sprint and they have real unlimited, I could see myself.
When is Sprint announcing? What are they saying that they think they're going to have LTE in Houston? Because I know who is it. T-Mobile says they're going to have it next year.
I had a blog post last week that said in 6 weeks, so mid-May, they'll be Sprint LTE.
So unlimited and LTE would be something if their LTE network is up to snuff.
Yeah, I would. Now, the other thing is that, you know, if you travel at all and you want LTE in other cities, you're going to have to wait a while for Sprint to catch up. Verizon has a bigger footprint than AT&T, and then it would be Sprint.
Right. Well, I know T-Mobile talked about they're going to be rolling out their LTE network with the idea that people could come to them with iPhones, even though they can't sell them.
Right.
They'd be able to use them on the T-Mobile network, which I guess would stop some of the hemorrhaging.
Right.
Which would be interesting because they actually do have unlimited. So.
Well, T-Mobile has unlimited up to a certain point, and then they start throttling. But they're upfront about that. If you cross that, I think it's 5 gigabyte limit on standard contracts, they'll start throttling you. And if you get a tiered service and you go over it, they throttle you past your tier points. Like if you have the 2 gigabyte service, they throttle you past the 2 gigabytes.
I just wonder, you know, I saw you posted where I guess you watched an hour of TV and used up a third of your monthly allotment or something on it.
I had used up a gig. I watched an hour's worth of 2 episodes of The Big C on the Showtime iPad app, and it was a full gigabyte for those two.
So I really wonder that. I think that there's going to be large and growing pressure on the carriers to come up with more realistic quantities of data available at the prices that they're charging.
Well, and there's this talk about. There's the talk about family data plans, which could provide, you know, some relief. Like if we were on a family data plan, I probably consume more data than anybody else. My kids don't use that much. And so, you know, I could scarf it and enjoy it. Taking it from the mouths of my children.
Family style.
Well, couldn't they just, you know, slow down the speed a little bit and then spread out the data to more people? So maybe you have a 2 gig limit, but it's at full speed. But they can cut that speed in half and have.
That's what T-Mobile does. That's what T-Mobile does. When you get past a certain point, they slow it down. You could continue.
No. I'm talking about you could sell somebody the idea. Your phone, instead of doing 10 megabits down for 2 gigs a month, you could do 5 gigabits.
Oh,
5 megabits for the same. You know.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
For 4 gig a month.
Yeah, I think it could get pretty complex.
Well, that's what they're you know, they got accountants for, they got bean counters for this sort of thing.
And computers.
So I mean if I'm gonna use up all my data real fast and instead I would just use it slower over a longer period of time. Maybe. I don't know. It does seem like, you know, the capabilities of the devices are exceeding the ability for the providers are going backwards as the devices are racing ahead.
It'll have to get pushed. I mean, if you know, there was never any market pressure, we'd still be paying for, you know, by the minute with AOL.
That's true. Goodbye,
or pay 10 cents for a text.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it's
having original text plans where it was 100 texts a month, and then everyone after it was a quarter or something, it doesn't cost them anything like that to put that kind of data around. They make so much money off texting.
There's only some kind of data sling box that you could go back to your home internet with. I guess you could run an Ethernet cable.
If you live close enough, and there's that when that Wi-Fi, what is it, the 802.22 version comes out, that'll do like 60 miles. Everybody will have their home be tethered to their home network.
That'd be awesome. Not really, but all right.
It might be.
You can have like a cantenna that has some kind of computer that always aims it at your house with another directional antenna on there, so you could always have a, you know, if you had line of sight. Living in Houston, so you'd have a better chance.
You could mount the cantenna on a hat and wear VR goggles at the same time, and you would look so cool.
You not would look really. Cool.
Yes. Looks disturbing.
Disturbingly cool.
Spinning around on your head and pointing, always pointing in the same direction, no matter what you do.
It's the propeller beady of the new age.
Of the 21st century.
Yeah. All right. 713-526-5738. It sounds like we all have sinus issues tonight, too. I think that's not helping with the overall sound quality inside
it's,
that.
Yeah, it's definitely pollen season.
Is it?
I think it's the LT prices are making us all cry.
All this new technology is making us cry with happiness.
Facebook buying Instagram's making you cry.
Hey, you know, Facebook, first of all, Instagram for the Android, polluting the Instagram market. Then everybody freaking out about Facebook buying Instagram. And, of course, there was just, you know, all this hype about Mac having that Trojan. Apple computers. It's
right.
Like, now my Windows computer isn't special anymore.
Flashback, or what was that?
The Flashback Trojan, yeah.
Flashback Trojan.
The thing is, if you have Xcode or developer tools installed, you can't get it.
Is that true?
That's what I've heard, yeah.
Why would that be true?
I've only been back for a little bit, but I heard I was safe. I have it on good authority.
They don't have Mac viruses in Ireland?
No, I don't know. I just want to, it'd be cool to be able to remember back. I wanted to get it because then I could at some point have a flashback to having flashback.
The Irish had that.
Never going to happen.
That guy that took all the viruses out of Ireland with a.
Right.
Yeah, what was that?
The viruses. Saint
virus.
Saint virus. The Saint virus dance.
He drove the Trojans out of the Apple computers in Ireland.
And all the beer out.
On Friday. All right, 713-526-5738. If you want to be on the air, Groove House is standing by, well, sitting by to. Take your call and put you in the queue to put you on the air for tonight's show. Man, I would really benefit from taking a nap right now. I would just like to lay down in this corner over here, put my
laptop
back.
You have like a big cup of coffee that you, is that it?
It's it, and it hasn't done anything for me. It's the pollen, it's just,
oh, yeah. And you have a Diet Coke there, too.
I'm drinking a Diet Coke now.
You're
to
two-fisted.
I'm ingesting caffeine as fast as I possibly can. What do you got,
Barry? So here's the deal. So apparently, it's not that it can't be installed, Flashback can't be installed on a machine with Xcode. It just looks to see if there's Xcode on there, and then it, for some reason, is scared of it and does not install itself.
Oh, that's however, right. There are certain things where when it sees that it's there,
it won't go.
Install.
However, it'll totally ignore Norton and McAfee. It just blows right by them. But yeah, if you had Xcode on there before all this broke out, you're safe because you're not a target.
Skype
at this point.
Is also
really?
Also will keep it off. Skype will keep it off, and Microsoft Office.
It's like digital garlic,
Mac. Because it wants to be stealth. It conflicts with those. That's right. Remember, it wants to be stealth. It conflicts with those. You see the conflicts, and you go, "Oh my god!"
And then you're looking,
and then you're looking for it, and so it won't install. That's right. I remember that now. Cool.
Well, there's a script, too, and if you go to the Technology Bytes Facebook page, I've posted on there, there's a script you can run to check your machine to see if you've got it.
And there are several antivirus programs, free ones, that were released today that will nuke it.
Yeah, but this, if you're still...
This is kind of a big deal then, huh?
So yeah, so if you're inclined not to install an antivirus even after this, the script is a pretty low, small footprint thing. It just runs and checks. And that's it. It doesn't install a package on your system or anything.
The number that has been kicked around. Pete, did you deal with this in your news?
He wasn't paying attention to all the news either.
No, you didn't pay attention? Okay. So there allegedly are 600,000 plus Mac machines that are infected with this based on the fact that the machines try to look for specific servers and a Russian... antivirus company set up a honeypot, basically, and so it's hearing from all of these servers. And, you know, there's been some debate about it, but a second antivirus company was able to confirm that this number is accurate. If you look at that number based on the total install base of Macs, it comes out to about 1% of the entire install base. And if you were to take that number and apply it against the installed Windows base, if you had a
1% of Windows,
1% of the Win, it would be a huge number. And there, and the only thing close to that, I think, was Blast, the MS Blaster worm, which infected a huge number of
Windows. Well, Apple's not even handling it well. I remember talking to some guys at the hackerspace in Dublin, and more or less Microsoft didn't even respond to the Russians. The Russians have been trying to tell them, like, for several days that, hey, you've got
compromises. You mean Apple had not
responded. Yeah, I'm sorry, what did I say?
You said it, Microsoft. Microsoft.
Oh, yeah, that's such... Actually, Microsoft works with security researchers really well. Apple's not.
When you're talking about people not responding to viruses, you often think of Microsoft.
Yeah, it's just, I say virus, Microsoft just comes out. It's like word association. But yeah, Apple's going to have to learn how to deal with outside parties, because that's where a lot of the fixes and a lot of this research is going to come from, and they did not do a good job of it when it first got
released. Well, they have been kind of bogged down with the antitrust.
Their issues have issues.
One of the reasons why the infection, there's so many machines out there that are infected, is because
nobody thinks they can get infected.
Well, nobody, but Apple dragged its heels on a fix. It had a patched version of Oracle fixed Java in February and released the fix, and Apple had not yet done its version of Java, which it supplies to OS X. And so only when it was... when it was heavily promoted that this was out there, did Apple release the version? I mean, they did it almost immediately, which means it was probably there waiting, and they just didn't do it. And that's, Apple has got to think about security more than it does now.
All right. 713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air with us tonight. We are taking calls here on Technology Bites. Looks like we have a call in the queue, but we have lots of open lines and plenty of time left in the show this evening. So if you want to call, 713-526-5738. Groove House.
Yes.
Who's up?
All right, up first on the show, we're going to take Eric.
Eric, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
For quality control, this conversation may be recorded. I've got a 65-year-old female friend. Her computer died. She's got Windows 7 on her hard drive. Bought her a new computer. People were supposed to transfer all of the user settings to the new computer, and all they did was just copy all the data and stuff to the desktop. Is there a way to get the user settings so that she can start this thing up just like the old one died?
Do you still have access to the old computer?
Yeah. The computer is dead. The hard drive is okay. So I'd have to hook it up via USB.
You should be able to, I'm not sure, can you do it with a, just reading from the hard drive? Can you do a migration tool from that, or do you have to do it while this, it's actually running?
I think you have to do it from a running a Windows 7 machine, or a running Windows machine. I don't think it'll just pull from a hard drive.
Where's the fun in that?
Well, one thing you could possibly do, and I don't know if this would blow up in your face or not, but what you could do is you could, on the new computer, is create a user account that matches the user account that's on the other system. So if her user account was this, say, Mary on the other computer, create a user called Mary on the new computer. The only thing you'd be able to do is pull over her user profile, which would have all the settings, but unless the applications are also installed, you won't have any of those settings.
There are no applications on there that you use.
I would take this wonderful opportunity to just set it all up again, unfortunately, without a backup. I don't.
Well, here's the problem. I've never touched a Windows machine in my life. So.
Okay.
Anything about them or where any of these files go. And they charge $70 to just copy the data to the desktop.
Have you gone back to these people and said that this is not what we agreed to and, you know, we wanted the settings?
Yeah, well, then they gave me a song and dance. Well, that gets into privacy issues. So they don't do the user-to-user migration like you can do in a Macintosh.
How dead is dead on the other computer?
It's dead. Turns on. The fans ramp up. Nothing on the screen. Nothing. And it's a 2007 gateway, so it's essentially worthless.
I would think there might be a tool. I'm trying to think if there's a migration tool that might look at just the file system.
You might look at Aloha Bob, which I think will do what you're... It's a program called Aloha Bob. It's designed to migrate Windows machines over in a variety of scenarios, and I think it might do what you're talking about.
Okay.
Is it possible that could look for the exact same gateway model used and swap hard drives?
It's possible. I mean, it sounds like a bit of an expense, if you found an exact model of the gateway computer that died and took the hard drive out of the dead one and put it into the one that works, and it would boot just like her old PC, more than likely. I mean, there's a slight chance that it would, and they do tend to change a few things in any given model. But Aloha Bob might be the way to go. It's a PC, what they call a PC relocator. I'm looking online to see it. The most recent article about Aloha Bob is 2002 that I'm seeing. Let's see, Ed Bott wrote something about it in 2006. I don't think it's around anymore, to tell you the truth.
So, he's in the retirement center.
Can you pull a virtual image off of a hard drive to run as a virtual machine?
You're talking to a guy who's never run Windows before in his life. You want him to set up a virtual machine?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I don't think you're paying enough attention to this call. What does she use the computer for?
Accessing the internet, playing solitaire. But she's got all of her bookmarks and her banking, whatever's in there. But she doesn't use any programs. No really email programs or...
Well, her face... Okay, and it's a Windows 7 computer that died, and it's a Windows 7 computer that she has now, right?
Yeah, I thought this would be...
Now, you say you've never used a Windows computer. You use a Mac?
Yeah.
Okay. On a Windows computer, for the user profile, it's pretty simple. There's a folder on Windows 7. It's C:\users/ whatever her username is.
All right.
In that folder, there's a favorites folder, which has all of her bookmarks. There's a My Documents folder, which has all of her documents and probably her images and stuff. So whatever they pulled off and they dropped on the desktop could be moved into these separate folders. So if you look at that folder that they created on her desktop and find those corresponding folders under her username, her user folder, you can drag and drop them right into there. So just like a Mac, you double-click a folder, it's going to open up and show you the contents.
All right.
So if you click on the Start button on Windows and then the computer icon, that's going to bring up the computer information that has, like, the hard drive and stuff. And then you'll see the C drive. You double-click on that. Then you'll see the directory tree. So you have, for user folders, as I said, it's C:\users/username. Whatever she's using that computer as, that folder there, you look inside of it, you'll see favorites, you'll see documents, you'll see desktop. So you'll have just about everything.
So just replace all those folders.
Right, just grab the corresponding folders out of the folder they dropped on the desktop over there. That should contain her user folder there. I wouldn't drag the whole user folder if they moved that, but I would grab the individual folders like favorites, documents, music, whatever, and bring those into the corresponding folders, and that should get her most of the way there. The only thing left to do would be to I don't know what email client she uses or if she uses any. Does she use, like, web-based email, or does she use Outlook, or what?
I have no idea.
Well, you'll find that out soon enough.
All right.
All right. Hopefully that'll get you most of the way there, though.
We'll give it a shot.
All right. Thanks, good luck. Thanks for your call. All right, got Barrett back pushing the buttons. That's good.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, all is right with the world. Now, I'm sure I've got the headphone off that actually has the flicked voice in it when it comes time to close the hour. So if you say something and I don't look up at you, know that I did not hear you. Wow.
We'll just say it over the air.
Yeah, Jay, hey, 2 minutes.
Jay, 2 minutes.
All right. 713-526-5738. There's about 8 minutes left before we 6 minutes left before we have to take a break. So we got time for another call, so let's do that. Groove House?
Yes.
Who's up?
Up next, we're going to take Greg.
Greg, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Yes. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate the service you're doing for the community.
Well, thank you.
We have about a 10 or 12-year-old compact computer with XP system on it.
Wow.
And when we try to turn it on, we cannot use the mouse or the keyboard. And I've tried other mouse, mice, and other keyboards, and it won't work. The screen comes on, and you have to log in or type in a password to get to go into the system, but we can't do that. Just wanted to see if you had any thoughts or comments on
that. I'm assuming that on a 10 to 12 year old computer, you probably have the PS2 style mouse, the round connectors for the mouse and the keyboard.
It may have like 6 or 7 pins in it.
Yeah. Those are called PS2 connections. Now, even though the computer's 10 to 12 years old, it should, if it's running XP, it should have USB ports.
Yeah, I think it does.
What you might do is get a USB mouse and a USB keyboard.
Okay.
And connect it to that computer after it's, you know, and boot it up. Now, it might take it a minute to recognize these devices and install drivers. So it may not immediately get mouse or keyboard activity on it, but give it a few minutes to settle, and then the mouse and the keyboard on the USB might work where the PS2 is not working.
Ah, okay. All right.
There's a good chance the PS2 keyboard is fossilized, I would think.
Fossilized?
That old, yeah.
He's making it.
But also the mouse, you know, is also dead, so it's probably the PS2
controller. He's making
a
joke about how old PS2 is.
Yeah, okay.
Fossilized.
You as a fossil should
recognize and laugh.
I'll try that.
Yeah, I would just say, you know, if you're lucky, you're using PS2, and by circumventing the PS2 system altogether and putting in USB devices, the system might just pick those up and then give you input. If I was having this problem, that's what I would do. I'd just go and get a cheap USB mouse and a cheap USB keyboard and connect it.
See if that'll make it work.
Yeah, okay. Like I said, especially because it's so old, it might take it like as much as 5 minutes to recognize the devices and install the drivers.
And okay. it'll say that it's
not
doing
right.
That.
Because he has
a login screen.
If you have a login screen, you won't see
that's
it.
Right.
You'll just see the mouse will occasionally go to an hourglass and then back to a cursor.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, it'll flash back and forth for a little while, and you keep hitting the keyboard, keep hitting Control-Alt-Delete. And if you're lucky, eventually you get the logon screen. And it might load the keyboard and take a little while longer for the mouse or vice versa. You might move the mouse around. And the mouse is moving, but nothing. The keyboard's not doing
it
anything.
It should load the keyboard because he would be able to do the, even before Windows loads, he'd be able to do with the USB keyboard.
But not with Windows. Because Windows still has to throw up a driver for the USB interface. So even though the keyboard would affect, like you could go into BIOS or mm-hmm. whatever, that'd be another question I'd be curious to know about is mm-hmm. if you could, if you know when the computer gives you the boot screen, you have that like hit delete to enter setup or F2 to enter setup.
Uh-huh.
Have you tried that? Does that work?
I don't recall if we get that screen. It's been a month or so since we looked at it, but I'll have to go back and look, but I will try that. So if I push the F2, that'll take me to the BIOS.
Yeah, it'll usually tell you, like, when it gives you the whatever model of the computer, if it's Gateway or Dell or whatever, it'll usually give you a little text screen before it goes to load Windows that says, press this key to enter setup or whatever. Is it a Dell? What model, what brand is it?
Compaq.
It's going to probably be F10.
Okay. All right.
BIOS.
Okay.
That's what I would try, though. I would just try the USB, though, and see, but... Because you're just going to bypass the whole PS2 system.
Yeah,
you might have gotten a short in the board or something.
Yeah. Can I ask another quick question?
Real quick.
Okay. I understand some of you guys are musicians or were one time. Are you aware of a software that you can buy where you can plug attach a tune to it, a CD, and slow it down to where you can get kind of determine what is being played and figure out the chords and the lead, the solos and stuff and...
Oh, so they would just slow the song down?
Yeah, kind of like we used to do with, you know, 33 and a third albums. You'd slow them down, you know, even slower and so forth, and try to listen to whatever it is you're trying to learn. But a software that might keep the same intonation and so forth. Are you aware of anything like that?
I'm trying to think. I don't know of one off the top. I know what exists. I know that you can do pitch corrections and stuff on music files. So I would Google search music player, MP3 player, slow pitch or fast pitch, or I don't know if those are good terms.
DJ programs can speed up and slow down to some level, but I don't know if it's gonna. I think it'll maintain pitch.
If you've ever used Winamp, which is still out there, you might even have it on there since it's an XP machine. There's Pacemaker and there's Slow Me Down, which are both Winamp plugins, and it'll actually let you do it. You can stretch the music out between 50 and 70%, and it actually won't change the pitch all that much. So you should be able to hear what's going on without it being Alvin and the Chipmunks or, you know, something super slow.
Well, I appreciate it. I'll look into that. Thank you for your time, man.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Bye-bye.
All right. Well, that's good. Stopping point here as we reach the top of the hour of this episode of Technology Bites. We need to take a short break and deal with some station business, but we'll be right back after a few quick messages. You are listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Dwight.
And he is
Groovehouse.
On May 4th, there will be a benefit concert for breast cancer survivors. Latin pop folk band Barrandua and other Latin composers, singers, songwriters will perform to raise funds for Pink Pilates, a nonprofit group which helps breast cancer survivors with their physical, emotional, and nutritional needs. Casa Argentina, along with the University of St. Thomas, will host the event at that university's Jones Hall on May 4th. At 8 p.m. The Night of Artists, including Martin Blito and Jay Simon, will perform original music and some of the greatest songs from Latin folk icon Mercedes Sosa and Facundo Cabral, both who passed recently, but whose music and poetry live on. For tickets, go to CasaArgentina.org. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, KPFT.org.
Listeners support KPFT in many different ways. Some write checks and others use credit cards, but if you're spinning your wheels looking for a tax deduction, think about donating your working but unwanted car, motorcycle, boat, or truck to KPFT. You'll qualify for a tax deduction and, at the same time, take care of unfinished business. To make a donation, call our toll-free vehicle donation hotline at 877-308-2408. We'll arrange for your vehicle to be picked up and the title transferred. Then we'll send you a receipt for your tax deduction. It's really that simple to support the station you have come to rely on for music, news, and public affairs programs. Again, for more information or to make a donation, call our toll-free vehicle donation hotline at 877-308-2408. You are tuned in to commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston.
Hey, Barrett, what's happening?
I don't know.
Well, room around town.
We interrupt this skit to bring you
Barrett Time! Barrett Time! Barrett Time!
Yeah. That means it's time for
Barrett Time!
Yeah. Anyway, take it away, Barrett.
All right. After the sheer amount of stout I've quaffed the last 2 weeks, I feel it only appropriate to lead off with something Guinness-related. Is everyone ready? I didn't mean for this to be some sort of Irish Inquisition, but we're going to do trivia. Okay, what was Alec Guinness's salary for playing the part of Obi-Wan Kenobi in the 1978 movie Star Wars?
$125.
Ooh, actually, wrong Guinness. Sorry, wrong Guinness. Here we go. Okay. According to the Guinness Book of World Records, what was the greatest-selling single computer model of all time?
Computer model?
Computer model.
Oh, model of computer?
Model of computer. Like, you know, Apple IIe or...
The greatest selling of all time?
Uh-huh.
It was the...
Commodore 64.
Ooh, Dwight gets it. Yeah, the venerable Commodore 64.
Who happened...
I thought it was going to be the PC Junior.
Yeah, yeah. And Alec Guinness earned $150K plus 2% of profits, which would arguably buy quite a bit of the other Guinness. It was also more than 2 1/3 times more K than the C64 had, of which, depending on... Where you source your information, between 12.5 million and 22 million units were sold. Dwight, you won that, so the next question's yours. How many bytes is that worldwide? Please state the median, the mode, and the standard deviation in terms of bits.
No.
Expressed in octal notation? Backwards.
No.
Now go.
No.
Okay. How about, when was production stopped on the Commodore 64?
Oh, I know this. 1984.
Oh, okay. Here's some math that'll help you guys out. So, introduced in January of 1982, the production run of the C64, the C64C, lasted 12 years and 3 months.
12 years
and 3 months, making that January 82, 12 years, 3 months.
85.
April of 94.
Wow.
If Alec had held on to his money for a few years, he could have bought 250 Commodore 64s
and still had money. That's right, because they made, like, different versions of it. They made...
Well, yeah, it went to the C64, and then they did the C64C was the last one that stopped
And they had a portable one, too. They had one that looked almost like a little compact.
That may not have been a C64.
It was a 64,
I have a Plus 4. Which is the Commodore 64 with 4 built-in programs.
I cast Magic Missile. Yeah.
There were a number of them out there. Yeah, if Alec had actually held on to his money for a few years, he could have bought 250 of them and still had money left over for a few copies of Tetris. So does anyone know what the retail price of the C64 was in 1982?
I bought one, so I should remember this. But
$4.99.
Oh, it's close.
$3.99.
No, higher, which is pretty expensive for $82, $595.
Wow. That didn't include the little disc drive.
No, that was just
the tape drive.
Or the TV or anything. That was just the base console.
We bought ours in a pawn shop.
That's probably the better way to go. On a side note, Alec Guinness was not a fan of the Obi-Wan character, going so far as to help convince George Lucas that the character should be killed off in order to limit the amount of work he would have to do in subsequent films. Yeah, and so the first Jedi Knight was cut down, leaving an indelible mark on so many young lives. Alec Guinness passed in 2000, having never had the chance to talk Lucas out of keeping Jar Jar Binks around for subsequent episodes. Sadly, we lost another noble knight this week in the form of Jack Tramiel, founder of Commodore International. Do you guys know what Jack Tramiel's original nationality was?
He was Polish?
Yeah. He was born in Poland in 1928 to a Jewish family.
Yeah, he was actually in a concentration
camp. Yeah, when the Germans invaded 8 years later. He spent time working in a garment factory in one of the ghettos before being sent to Auschwitz, the concentration camp with his mother and father. He was actually inspected by Dr. Mengele, and he was transported to a labor camp near Hanover, where he managed to survive until the camp was liberated by the 84th Infantry Division in 1945. And Tramiel actually was the co-founder of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, which was opened up in 1993. So I'm not going to try and pronounce his birth name, but what does his last name, spelled T-R-Z-M-E-I-L, mean in Polish?
That sounds like a question for Afflicted.
Afflicted.
What was the spelling?
T-R-Z-M-E-I-L. It's just the Polish version of Tramiel. Bumblebee. Huh. That's actually true. It's pretty cool. His Flight of the Bumblebee was probably one of the first data sets I ever spent a weekend typing into a VIC-20, only to lose it all the next power cycle. November of 1947, Tramiel took flight and immigrated to the United States and soon volunteered for the U.S. Army, where he learned what skill? It's kind of the gimme. This is what sets everything else up.
Code breaking.
Yes. No. Now, he learned how to repair office equipment, namely typewriters. Commodore was actually not Jack's first choice, the name of his new company. Do you guys know what the other contenders were?
Atari.
No, later.
Sinclair.
Lionel Richie.
Yes, Lionel Richie. Actually, that was taken. So having just come out of the Army, he was looking for something strong. So both Admiral and General were already taken. When he saw an Opel Commodore from the backseat of a cab, he had his name. Maybe our next trivia question should be, what is an Opel Commodore?
It's a car.
It's a trap. Sorry.
F-trap.
Had to get one more Star Wars reference in there. That's it. Yeah, that's it for the end of an era and an Irish Inquisition, and that's that for Barrett time.
Salute. Slante.
Salud.
Slanche.
Slanch.
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 Slanch it down.
It's a trap.
It's a trap.
So good to see that, Jay or someone in my absence actually covered his passing on the Geek page on our Technology Bites page.
Groovehouse. Groovehouse quietly participates in the show via the Facebook fan page.
I may not show up to the Geek Gallery.
Come to Geek Gallery.
And I'll show up on the
He'll quietly just put Facebook up something page. Real. I actually put up a great, there's a new photo on the Facebook fan page I put up today.
Okay.
The Rebel base. They found the Rebel base.
Okay. I got to go look.
Boom, boom.
All right. 713-526-573. You can find us. What?
How was the Geek Gathering?
The Geek Gathering was very mellow. I got stuck at the table where politics were being discussed while Dwight was hanging out with Loopy Lou and Afflicted drinking drinking some kind of, bubbly and smoking Prosecco and smoking cigar. So I chose poorly table wise. But the weather was fantastic. It was great for hanging out. It was the whole full moon thing going on,
It was nice and cool.
It was great.
And Dwight was super relaxed because he didn't have to go home. He knows his phone never went, it's me, it's me, it's me, that I could hear. So, yeah, it was pretty good.
Good.
I'm going to miss the next Geek Gathering, but I guess I'll throw together a flyer and stuff for it. So we
can, a big ad?
A big ad, yeah. I'll make sure I have all my ducks in a row before I go.
Whank.
All right, Groovehouse.
Oh, we lost
no calls.
Monica.
We lost she our calls. Don't give up.
I know. She was only on hold for like 18 minutes.
Call back, Monica.
Monica, I know your cell phone probably died, but 713-526-5738. All the lines are open.
She was our only hope.
And her hologram just faded away.
That's right.
It's a trap. 713-526-5738. You know, there are some strange things on the internet.
There are?
Is there? Really?
Is there?
Oh, like my what? God.
What have you seen lately? Tell us.
Wait
all
a pounce.
All I see is like cat pictures.
Wait. If I would be allowed to finish my comment. There are some, what I meant to say was there are some strange things that were on the internet.
They're gone? Where'd they go?
They are gone. There are little pieces of early internet history that I remember actually happened. And you can't find them. One of them, for example, which I'm surprised by, is Bonsai Kitten.
Wow. Oh, that had PETA issues. That got
yes,
taken down.
Yes, but it got taken down. It got sued. It got chased all over the place. But it does not exist in archive. There are like one or two photos that I've ever found from the original site out there in the wild.
Is the dancing baby still out there?
I would imagine the dancing baby is out there. But I'll tell you what prompted this comment from me. Is there was a game, there was a PC game called Progress Wars, which showed two cross swords and had the original Windows 3.1.1 blue dot progress bar.
I remember that.
And you would basically, it would say, you know, you would load it up and it would say, you know, kill orc, find gold, eat food, and it would just level you up. You would just watch it, and it would just, you would, like, it was like playing a role-playing game, and you would level up, and they had a tote board, and all, you know, and whoever played, but so I went looking for it, and there's a new one. There's a new Progress Wars, but it's a website, and you just, it says slay an orc, and you press the button, and you just keep, but you don't log in, it doesn't have a tote.
Right.
But it's totally new graphic, but there's no, did you find a bonsai?
Our web, archive.org, you've got to go to the Wayback Machine. Go all the way back to 2006 is the last time it was really around.
Okay, how many of the images do they still have? Because
for those who don't know, you might explain what
the Bonsai Kitten.
And it's B-O-N-S-A-I.
B-O-N-S-A-I. Bonsai Kitten was this. It was a group of MIT guys, actually. They had created this site, which was a parody or joke site about taking cats and putting them into jars and molding them into shapes. And they, you know, they had a picture of a cat laying down with some, what looked to be like some kind of stretching tool. It was somebody's cat laid down next to this thing, but took a photograph of it. It looked like the cat was being stretched. Totally. And then they had pictures of cats that willingly went into jars looking around, and you have this distorted picture of a cat. Well, the animal rights people just lost their minds over this, thinking that
it was real.
It was real, or even if it wasn't real, that it was somehow promoting
growing jars and cats.
Jarring cats and hurting cats. Because they got this one picture of a cat being shoehorned into a jar. It's total parody. But they got chased down by the FBI, shut them down, or, you know, they had to move it off the MIT servers. They had to move it to another server, and then it finally got shut down. So it's good to know that it's still kind of.
They're full instructions, yeah. Even including you want to give your kitten a muscle relaxant 30 minutes prior to insertion into the glass jar. And then you can grow them from there because, you know, it's like shipping the bottle.
It was like a bonsai tree where you
right,
shape
you grow
it as it
right.
grows.
Right.
So, yeah. But it's odd to me that. You know, I mean, I believe that's good that you can find it in the archives, but like just in the wild at a Google search, nobody has that. It's like one of those things that, like, let's pretend this never happened on the internet. And there are things like that I've gone looking for that have never, I can't find anymore. What's also interesting is there are things that weren't on the internet, you know, like music or song lyrics or something from songs pre-internet days that you couldn't find initially that all of a sudden that stuff's flooding onto the internet.
So the reason why you didn't find it is because you didn't search properly.
Did I spell it wrong?
No, you put it in. You put it in, there's a Wikipedia entry on it.
Yeah.
You put it in quotes. B-O-N-S-A-I in quotes.
Well, there's a Wikipedia article about it up now, which I don't think existed before. But unless I was spelling
somebody
it wrong.
Just did it because they heard us talking.
Oh
about
yeah,
it.
They stood up.
Snopes has a thing on it. BonsaiKitten at ding.net.
Someone's making a plushie, like a plush
oh,
toy.
Here it is. Here it is.
Yeah, that's it.
It's back.
Oh, ding.net. Someone's got it.
Yeah, wow. Ding.net.
All right, it's back then. Somebody brought it back. Because yeah. I found a couple of the original images at one point when I was searching, but I was more interested in trying to find a graphic of the original Progress Wars.
We had...
At least it lasted, because... Did you see the whole texts with Hills or texts with
yes.
Hillary?
Yes.
That meet like started last week and they shut it down today.
Because she submitted her own text.
A real one.
A real one, yeah, herself. And they said, how can we top that? You know, so they shut it down. Better
but
that.
Think about the reach on that.
That's not the original, that's the new one.
Yeah.
It was basically a goof meme. And it went from hipsters and people laughing at it and sharing it up to the Secretary of State of the United States, who then responded, and that ended it.
And then, yeah,
in
it's kind of like
7 days.
It's kind of like time traveling and seeing yourself or mentioning Hitler in an internet argument. It ends it.
So once the subject of the parody or the meme enters the meme.
Although sometimes it's in the reverse, like Scarlett Johansson, you know, where she started it and then it kind of expanded and petered out after that, so to speak.
Did they expand, Troy?
A little bit.
So think about Hillary is making you expand. What?
No, Scarlett.
I think it's time to take a call.
It might very well be.
Very true.
All right, Groove House?
Yes.
Who's up?
All right, up first on the second half of the show, we're going to start with... Tanny.
Tanny, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good.
Hey, let's see if I can condense the situation. The question's pretty simple, though. At work, I brought my own computer in there, and I'm not part of the domain, and they just recently installed a firewall. And the IT guys are cool with me, and they'd love to let me through it, but since I'm not part of the domain, they can't do it. I was wondering, I have Windows 7, but it's not the version that allows you to add yourself to... I don't know if it's just a work group as well or if it's the same thing, but I can't get on the domain, so...
Well, on an Active Directory domain, to be able to join a computer to the domain, they have to give you permissions in Active Directory to join the computer to the domain.
Okay.
Unless you can't just do... account. Unless you log in with an admin account.
And that's what
box.
I was thinking. The main problem is I can log in. I have an account, but since I brought mine in, I'm using my username. All my files are there, all the stuff I do. Is there any easy way to migrate... my main user over to the username I use to log on to the domain, so I can just integrate the two, because that's the main reason if I log into the computer with
why are you using your own
it's just like a pretty much a fresh install. Well, I came in there later and I had a bunch of work that I had done on the computer, and I was just kind of comfortable with my setup.
Why I mean, how big is the company? I mean, do they have an IT department that's there in place to help you with this kind of thing, or
yeah,
is this kind of
they're one cube over, so. But they kind of told me, you know, that's just something you'll have to do. They didn't really know the answer to the question of how I can, I don't know, I guess, merge the two.
Well, why do you have to be, why do you have to even be on the domain?
Well, the only reason I want to be on the domain is so that they can allow me to pass through the firewall.
So your computer actually has to be on the domain before it can route past the firewall? Now, we're talking about being on the domain, not being on the network, because at my office... You can have computers that are members of the domain, and you can have computers that are just logged in locally, connected to the Ethernet, and they can move around the network pretty freely as long as you have credentials to authenticate certain resources.
Yeah, and that's what I hope. Maybe there's a way that I can just authenticate my internet access through the domain user, but they said that it's a WebSense. Set up, but
okay, so the WebSense is tied. The WebSense is tied to your username on the domain.
Yes, yeah, okay. That's how they have it set up.
Well, so here, if it was me and you were one of my users on my network, and you were trying to bring your own home computer in, I would probably tell you not to do it. And I would probably also get really upset if you came to me saying, well, the guys on the radio show said do this. So yeah. That being said, if you were to do it, then, and I don't know about Flickr, I mean, you have to have permissions on the domain before you can join a computer to the domain. So he doesn't have those, I would imagine.
I can get them, though. Like, they could grant it. They could work something
that's
out.
What I'm saying is if he lets one of them
log in,
isn't a domain admin account,
right,
log on, then they can run the commands to add his computer to the domain.
Right. So your computer could be joined to the domain, and then you would have to, you know, probably have one of your IT guys actually do that. But you said the computer doesn't. Is there a version of Windows 7 that does not support domains?
I feel like that's what they had told me.
Maybe home?
Maybe home might not have.
Well, but home premium is the one that is sold in the U.S. Home, the plain home or
right.
starter won't. But home premium, I think, will join domains.
All right. If you can't join the domain, you're out of luck. But if the computer will let you join the domain, then you have one of your domain admins join the domain.
Okay.
So let's assume that it can be joined to the domain for the purposes of this conversation, because if it can't, then you're just up a creek. So you join it to the domain. You're going to log in with your domain username and password. You're going to get a desktop that's just the default desktop. It's not going to be any of your customizations. It's not going to have any of your personal files or anything. But those files and those things are in your user folder. You can go and grab them and move them into the corresponding user folder for your domain name.
Okay, that's pretty much it. I can drag all those files over.
You can go to c:\users/ whatever your local user account is.
Yeah.
Grab those files and folders and move them into c:\users/ your domain account.
And hope for the best.
And it should work fine.
Cool.
The only thing that would be left would be configuring like Outlook or anything that any shares that connect to network resources. You'd have to reset those up, but that shouldn't
be changing my wallpaper, of course.
Of course, to make it match your official office work wallpaper.
Yep, yeah.
So why are you using your own computer instead?
Yeah. Say that again.
Why are you using your own computer? Why isn't your company providing?
Well, I came in there to do mostly graphic design, video editing stuff. So none of the PCs I had set up. I mean, it's not really mine, but my boss, you know, gave me his card to go buy this. It's one of the fancy Dells, pretty quick and whatnot. But,
I see.
You know, from there, I just started setting it up on my own. You know, I didn't start from where I should have, I guess.
Oh, I see. So you got the company bought you the PC. You went ahead and went ahead of IT and started setting it up, got it all configured under your local account, and you realized, oh, well, this isn't going to work on the network. So you're trying to clean that up.
It was fine. And then a month later, they installed WebSense. So.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's the way I would do it.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds pretty simple.
Should be.
Perfect. Thanks, guys.
All right. Thanks for your call.
Take care.
All right. All right.
If you're really good friends with the IT guys, you could see if you could get them to put in an exception for your MAC address.
And if you're not really good friends with them, just bring them beer until you become good friends with them.
I've seen WebSense in action, but I don't know exactly how it works, how it tells, you know.
That's kind of funky. I haven't heard a lot of firewalls being tied down to a domain like that. Like, ours is pretty separate.
It could just be web traffic, though. Because I know WebSense is used a lot for web traffic.
Like filtering and
this site.
All right. ThinkGeek has a Bonsai Kitty plush doll.
Yes, that's, yeah.
offend your cat loving friends with a cat in a jar.
This website contains lingerie.
Which one?
This website contains adult content.
This site has been categorized as
adult content.
Gambling.
Now, what am I missing? WebSense.
Animal cruelty.
WebSense.
That's what it does. It pops up a message, and it says, this website.
But I wonder if WebSense ties into Active Directory in a way that says, you know, that if you're VP level, you can become part of a security group that bypasses WebSense. Or
I don't know.
So I don't know WebSense that well.
Because the thing is, there's probably different ways to implement.
Really well.
Because I've worked as an end user having to go through WebSense and some other products. but not as an admin of it.
There's a lot of plugins and a lot of things, I guess, the last 2 years that let WebSense communicate to Active Directory in native mode. So it looks like with some rules, you can go in there and you can do that.
So you probably could have an exception list.
Yeah, so it looks like Active Directory communicates the IP address, then that opens it up from there. It's just kind of, so you could probably fake it or you could do different stuff. I don't know Windows that well.
ThinkGeek owns BonsaiKitten.com now.
Whoa.
So if you go to BonsaiKitten.com, it takes you to the ThinkGeek page. I wonder when that happened.
And because they're the ones that are selling carrying the plush. It, yeah.
Right.
The
jar.
Oh, but, wow. That's cool. Yeah.
That's kind of cool, kind of not.
It takes you right to the plushie.
Yeah. They've got to redirect right to their to the plushie doll because they know people are still looking for it, I guess.
What happens if you go to goatsy.cx?
You tell
oh,
me.
Oh, they've got to plush you that.
You know what? They do have, I found a website, a guy, I think he was in Australia or somewhere, was making ceramic mugs and shot glasses of Goatsy.
Oh,
yeah, wow. So the handles were hands.
Oh, you know, there's no need for that.
And the inside of the cup was...
Yeah,
that's not, it's not.
Let's take a call. So.
Do you know that Gawker actually tracked him down?
Goatsy?
Yep.
I know that people had been trying to figure out who he was.
They figured
it out. I read an article about because in the picture, he's got like one or two rings on his fingers. And so they tracked it to some other sites of people that do crazy stuff. And found some other pictures of somebody doing similar stuff mm-hmm. with the same rings, and they tracked it to who the person was. Yeah. So, yeah, they know who that person is.
Were they local? Was it like an A&M class ring, or what was it?
I don't remember what ring that person was wearing.
Gawker has a whole story on it.
Let's just revel in this moment.
Let's just move on.
713-526-5738 is the number to call if you want to be on the air. We got about 30 minutes left, which we'll be taking calls. If you'd like to participate, now is the time to dial in. 713-526-KPFT. Groovehouse,
yes.
I see we have a call in the queue.
We do.
Who is it?
All right, up
and
next.
What do they want?
You want me to tell you what they want, or do you want me to let them tell us what they want? I'll tell you.
No, we'll let them tell us.
Okay. Up next, we're going to take George.
George, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hey, guys. How y'all doing this evening?
Good. How are you?
I would be a little bit better if I wasn't so frustrated along with my daily tasks and grind. But what I have, I'll try to make it quick. I'm, you know, kind of ignorant when it comes down to this stuff, and I kind of walk my way through it. A couple of weeks ago, I was web browsing and doing some other things, and a deal came up called Smart Fortress 2012, and what it was saying was that my computer was not secure.
Right, you got a cop. You got some fake anti-spyware on your system. A fake anti-spyware called Fortress.
Yeah, it's,
Fortress 2012 is what I'm seeing. Smart Fortress 2012.
Yeah. Exactly, and what it does. I got McAfee, and then I installed also the deal you guys told me about, Malwarebytes.
Uh-huh.
And everything up to that point, like I say, this is the funny part, and when I do go to my security point, number one, it pops up and tries to, it's almost like it's trying to blind me from looking at the
right, the spyware is designed to protect itself. It's designed to keep you from being able to launch certain programs or be able to bring up your task manager. It does a lot of really nasty stuff to your computer. And it is very difficult to remove.
Yeah, because right now I'm at my McAfee security center.
Forget McAfee, because McAfee's not going to help.
Okay, because it keeps telling me my firewall is off, and if I try to turn it on, it turns it back off.
Right, I understand. I got it. I understand.
When I go to my other security system to double check, it tells me that everything is quote unquote functioning. Everything is
right. Let me just stop you here. And you said you wanted to keep it short and quick. I know. I understand. I got it. I totally got it. You've got this nasty piece of crap on your PC, and it's not letting you use your computer the way you want to use it. To get rid of it, you're going to have to jump through some hoops to get rid of it.
Okay.
Now, the best option that you will have, aside from just wiping the hard drive clean and reinstalling everything, which nobody wants to do, there is a website called Bleeping Computer, you know, like, you know, instead of the whatever computer, Bleeping Computer.
I seen it the other day.
Yeah, Bleeping Computer. If you Google search Bleeping Computer Fortress Spyware, they have a removal guide.
Okay.
So you'll probably have to go to that on a computer that's not infected and print it out.
Okay.
But it tells you what it is. It goes through it, talks about the steps that you need and the softwares you'll need to be able to get rid of it. One of the steps in the process is to start computer in safe mode with networking, which will hopefully mitigate some of the problems you're having. But this has photos or, you know, images, step-by-step instructions on how to try to get this off of your computer.
Okay, right quick, I've actually pulled it up just to be honest, to see what it had. Would I want to go to the virus removal or remove security shield or startup program database?
I'm looking at a site. I'm looking at the site bleepingcomputer.com/virus-removal/remove-smart-fortress-2012.
Okay.
So, I don't think you found the page I'm talking about. So, Fortress Spyware Bleeping Computer. Just put that into Google and go for it.
Okay. I'm recording this show, so I'll be able to go back and listen to it.
All right, you'll find it. It's Remove Smart Fortress 2012 Bleeping Computer. They have an uninstall guide there. It'll take you through the steps that you need to go through to get rid of it.
Okay. I sure appreciate it.
All right, good luck. Thanks for your call. And it's frustrating, too, because this particular brand or this latest batch of fake antiviruses, for a while their Windows 7 was kind of running along, at least at my office. I wasn't seeing so many of these infections, but they've started to crop up pretty dramatically. There's been a large number of them, and they seem to be coming from legitimate sites. I mean, the people are telling me that they're not visiting questionable sites or they're not, you know.
Poisoned ad servers.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Mm-hmm. Poisoned ad servers. Exactly the point.
For example, earlier this week, Ars Technica, which is a very reputable technology site, suddenly began throwing up on Safari and Google the red screen that says this site is infected with malware. And in order to get back in the good graces of Google, they had to actually turn off their ad server because they were getting injections through their ad server. So once that happened and they got it cleaned up, they were able to do it. But that has happened, I think, to us in the past.
Yeah.
It's a real pain because you got to since you have to find the ad that's doing it and get it off of there.
Is there a tool you can use that finds that? I mean, do you host your own ad server or do you subscribe to an ad server? How does that work?
The problem usually comes in most sites have a variety of things. You can have your own ad server. You can get it. You can host it through us. Like Yahoo, for example, has an ad service. Google has an ad service. And what they will do is you have your own ads in it, but if your ads aren't sold out, then they can sell ads themselves, and they may have an auction system for selling it where somebody can say, I'll bid to be on it. And in theory, they check the ads or the ads are checked automatically, but sometimes some of these can get through, and once they get through, they just start pushing them and pushing them.
Well, that was been my suspicion for a while. I don't know exactly how the online advertising works for these various sites, but I suspect that ad packages are being compromised, whether it's intentional from the person that sells the ad in the first place or whether it's been hijacked by somebody else.
Yes, sometimes there are like chains of, you know, ad resellers, and anywhere in that chain it can be it can be hijacked. And sometimes you'll have I've heard of cases in which essentially a legitimate ad service is spoofed, is hacked. Somebody goes in there, messes with their domain or their DNS and hijacks it and then begins injecting ads, even though it appears to be coming from a legitimate site.
So it's not always a given that people that have this stuff showing up on their PC are browsing shady sites anymore. Used to be that you could pretty much count on that.
Right.
But these days, legitimate sites like you know, news sites and other reputable sites are getting this stuff injected into them, and it's affecting people. And it seems to be getting right around Windows 7 security issue, security measures. So, and I want to be clear, you know, for the caller that just called in and to anybody else listening, you know, you start trying to chase this stuff down with the standard antivirus packages like McAfee or Norton or anything like that, you're not, it's not going to detect anything. It's going to, if you can get it to run, it'll scan the whole system and say there is not a problem. And all the while, these things are flashing up on you. So spyware is not considered to be a virus per se. It's malware. It's not, but because of the way that it gets installed, taking it either advantage of an exploit through a web browser or by tricking you into clicking a link that actually, you know, gives it permission to install, the antivirus software just doesn't detect on that because it's stuff has to be allowed to run on your computer once you tell it to run. You can't have software that second guesses everything. So that's how this stuff gets past you. And that's the Norton or McAfee, those programs simply won't always catch it. And even the good anti-spyware programs don't always all catch it. I've scanned with Malwarebytes and not found it, and then turned around and scanned with Hitman Pro and it found it. So sometimes you have to use a battery or an arsenal of tools to try to get rid of this stuff. All right, 713-526-5738. I see one call coming in that Groovehouse is screening right now. The rest of the lines are open. About 25 minutes left in the show. If you want to call in, 713-526-5738. 713-526-KPFT is the number to call if you'd like to be on the air. Now, you got to be careful. If you're calling in to get on the air, Groovehouse is going to ask you your name and basically a summary, quick, you know, half a sentence of what your problem is and put you in the queue. But if you ask him your computer question or try to explain it in too great a detail, it causes the rest of us to have to keep talking and talking and talking until Groovehouse gets free and gets him in the queue, which he has done just now.
Yes, how can I help you?
That's why we were filling.
Okay.
We were stretching.
Stretch it.
Yeah.
You got it.
All right, Groovehouse.
Yes.
Who's up?
All right, up next, we're going to take Gary.
Gary, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Okay, thanks. I just got real interested in this situation with the ad servers and the ads. I'm just curious as to if you guys can give us some guidelines on how far you have to go for one of these to get activated. Do you actually, did it just come on if you get to the wrong website? Do you have to click on an ad? Do you have to click on an install and
now, what,
go through an installation process?
It depends on the malware. If you, some malware takes advantage of holes in either, say, a program that's on your computer or in your operating system exploits, and you don't have to do anything. You just go there.
And it installs.
And it installs, and you don't even know it's happened. No. In other cases, like the call we just took, you get a pop-up that looks like a Windows system alert. And people are fooled by it, and they click on it, yeah. And that causes it to be installed.
Yeah, some of them will pop up where it'll look like you have an X to close it, but the X is actually the follow link, so it actually takes you forward. So by the time you kind of figure out that this is going on, you may or may not have actually clicked on something, and it gets installed. But I've seen it. It comes on, and it can also appear to be coming. Sometimes it's a delayed reaction, because I had one in my office where one of my coworkers sent out a tweet with a link to an article that she was interviewed for this website, and one of her coworkers or our coworkers followed that link, and then all of a sudden this antivirus thing, this fake antivirus, popped up on his machine. Well, he assumed that it was that site, and I went ahead and went to the site and I reloaded it numerous times and never had anything show up that was untoward. So I have to assume that it was a delayed reaction from another site he had visited. Or another thing that I've seen happen is that this, some of these spywares will jump over the network from one PC to the other. I was using remote desktop on an infected computer to try to clean it up, and my computer became infected. Mm. With the same thing started running and loading up on my PC. So it can be very sophisticated, and it seems to happen very, very fast. So my advice is always just keep your data backed up. In a worst case scenario, you can always, you know, either use System Restore and go back to an earlier point, or just reload your system if you find yourself overwhelmed.
So you can use System Restore, and that would...
Sometimes it will. Sometimes if you use System Restore, if you have a restore point before the infection, it will sometimes get you back to a working state. Now, the file is still there. The executable file is still there, but there's no registry notation to load it in the previous. So sometimes that'll fix it.
Although, one thing you have to watch out for is that some malware infects the restore points.
Some malware, it gets, because it may have been there previously and you didn't know it, got picked up in a restore point as part of the system restore process. And I guess there are some others that will actually look for system restore points and inject itself there. So sometimes I've had maybe, 50-50 luck on system restore.
Can you, when one of these things pops up, to save yourself from like clicking on the X and not actually activating it, could you do a Control-Alt-Delete and then close it out to the task manager or something? Would that work?
The one that I have seen that seems to be the most successful is if when something like this shows up on your computer, if you can bring up the task manager, you can kill off all the iExplore processes, and that sometimes will let you get everything closed down, because it's all it is internet. It's a web page pop-up most of the time. If it's anything else, it's already too late. If you've got a program running and you start to get that little red X down in your taskbar next to the clock, it's probably too late.
That's the most insidious thing I've heard in a long time, the way they're getting with this stuff.
Oh, it's nasty. And there's people, that's all they have to do all day long is figure out ways to get this onto your PC.
It's kind of
distressing. In fact, it is very distressing. I mean, I don't even trust browsing to legitimate sites sometimes, because people will, what they'll do is they'll go to Google and they'll search for something, and they'll just hit the link on Google. They don't look to see if it's from a CNN or if it's from a CZZ or whatever the website is, and they'll think that they've found pay dirt, and it'll take them to a site that has some, what these spyware developers also do is that they try to inject the links to their stuff into the search engines. So when you go to search for key phrases, their link, the infected link, will show up as the first one. So they make great efforts to make sure that their website is the one that you find in any given search based on the subject matter.
Wow.
It's a mess.
That's all else. Well, thanks, guys, for your expertise. I think I feel a little bit safer for sure.
All right. Thanks for your call.
Bye-bye.
And clearly you can't anymore say get a Mac, because
Still, I mean, I still feel better, using a Mac. I mean, when I want to test out to see if a link is bad, I'll run it on my Mac just to see what happens. But I will still say, back up your data. Before it was just
in case.
It used to be just a hardware failure that you're worried about, but now with how bad these viruses are, reloading your system may become reality. And like Pete's about to tell us, it is cheap to do it now.
Yeah, I mean, even with the hard drive shortage, the prices on external hard drives has come way down. And backing up your stuff, if you have a Mac, they have Time Machine, which you can set up the best backup you pretty much can use by just plugging in a drive, and it'll say, do you want to use this for Time Machine? You say yes, and boom, you're covered.
I think the problem with backups and restores is that's probably the one aspect of computing that people universally understand the least. It's like nobody confronts a system reload unless it becomes absolutely necessary to do it. So some people may own a computer 5 years, 10 years, or whatever, and never have to do that. And then when it happens, you haven't been paying any attention to what's involved, and so it's a complete mystery. It's like, okay, my computer just died. What do I do? Even if they had made a backup, how do I use it? How do I know I'm getting my stuff backed up? So it can be intimidating. So I do recommend, like Pete said, get something, at least do something. Get something backed up. And there are ways to peruse your backups to make sure you're getting everything, to make sure that you actually have your data backed up. All right, well, all the phone lines are blank again. It's been a while since we had a good spyware show. Now I really want to take a nap. 713-526-5738. 713-526-KPFT. Sometimes when I'm talking about things like viruses and spyware and all the evil and awful that's out there on the web, it does make me tired. Just
that there's well, it's so just much, relentless.
It's just so much energy is expended creating this crud and then having to clean it up and, you know, figure it out and keep everything running in spite of it.
And people, you know, there are things you can do to prevent it. You can run, you can make sure that all the software you have is updated, your operating system, your applications. Remember that in the case of the flashback Trojan, what let it in was Java, which is not necessarily part of the operating system.
Right.
And that's been an increasing vector on all platforms is third-party programs that have Adobe Acrobat, you know, the PDF reader. You have to keep everything up to date, as well as be smart about what you do online.
Yeah, but what you do online is becoming, you know, it's more ambiguous than ever. It used to be, like we were talking earlier, it used to be you kind of had to go down a dark alley before you got jumped and knifed in the back with spyware. But now you could be walking right down Main Street of the Internet and have it hit you and have it get you.
I'm going back to print magazines and mail order catalogs.
You know, watch out because laser printers are also susceptible. Yeah. You want dot matrix only.
We had a caller call in and ask about online backup storage type things. Okay. Or how reliable are those? Are those worth doing?
There are some that are out there. The issue is, though, that if you've got a decent amount of data to back up, it's either going to take a long time or it's going to take a long time. That's usually what it comes down to. Because a lot of people's, their upstream transmitting is sometimes, you know, as much as like a tenth less than their downstream. So even though you might be able to download stuff fast, uploading stuff is...
You could also run afoul of data caps. You know, You can, if you're backing up a lot of data, they're certainly reliable. The ones that are out there that are legit, like Acronis or the others that, you know, been around, it's reliable. It'll work. You upload your data to the server. They've got redundancies in place to protect your data. So if the server you backed up to crashes, it's on another server. There's a lot of appeal to that. Plus, you know, your backups are useless if your whole system gets torched or stolen or whatever. So having it backed up to a service like that has benefits that, you know, if you have it all in one place at your house, it can all be lost. You can back it up to an external hard drive. Both your computer and your external hard drive get stolen. You don't have your backups.
Yeah, I wrote last year about a guy in California who was cut off by Comcast. Comcast's rule is that I think if you go over your monthly data cap twice and you're warned about it, they shut you off for a year. They basically suspend your service for a year. And what happened to him was he had online backup and he had a huge amount of data and he'd set the online backup to back it up fresh every time as opposed to back up the incrementals. And so very quickly he ran and he wasn't realized he'd done that. And he very quickly, ran out and wound up getting cut off. And he didn't realize that his uploads were counted against the data cap. And they are.
Yeah.
It's total data transfer. So that's something to keep in mind.
So, you know, I mean, for the most basic purposes of backing up, an external hard drive will usually do it. If you want to be extra safe, you can back up, you know, and rotate your backups and store them off-site, you know, or you can get one of those fireproof, waterproof external hard drives. For most of us, just one hard drive connected to the computer for backups is probably enough. You know, the main thing you want to save, and I think it's worth mentioning, the main thing you want to save is the data that can't be replaced. You don't care about operating systems and applications so much because you can always get the disk and reinstall it. The stuff that you want to save are your email archives, your documents, your photos, your videos, that kind of stuff. The stuff that can't be replaced by reinstalling, all the data that you create yourself. If you save nothing else, if you back nothing else up, back up your images and your documents and your email so that you have your personal information. The rest of it can be sorted out. You know, it's like if it can be fixed by paying money out, it's not so much a problem. It's just an expense. So, you know, deal with that. But photos and that kind of personal stuff that can't be replaced, that's what's going to really hurt when the hard drive dies or the computer has to be wiped and reloaded.
If you're trying to find like cloud storage on the cheap, the best deal I found so far has been like Amazon. So if you've got an Amazon account, you can go sign up for S3, which is a simple storage solution. And it's just, it's more or less, it's cloud storage. It's kind of hard to get in there, but Firefox has, I think it's called S3 Fox, and it's like a drag and drop through Firefox.
Really?
So it's really cheap. It's just a couple cents per month per megabyte. And then they charge you for in and outbound a little bit more. But the idea is that if you've got, like, you know, your best 500 pictures, your best whatever, you put it up there, you forget about it. And I've got probably, you know, wedding pictures and just, you know, just stuff like that. But probably 20 gigs of data, and it's less than a buck a month. I think it's like 80 cents a month just to keep it out there, for, you know, for wow. 10 or 15, 20 gigs.
That's a good price. That's not bad at all. You know, I just bought my third terabyte dual array drive because for my photos. Filling them up. I was surprised that the 2 and 4 terabyte RAID systems are not as cheap as I was thinking they should be. It's still expensive to buy this.
A lot of that may have to do with the hard drive shortage at the moment, but it's you know, it can be once you get it set up. Getting it set up can be a problem, particularly on Windows machines. But once you get it set up, doing backup on a hard drive is pretty much set it and forget it. You know, once it's up and running on the Mac, you plug in Time Machine, it says you want to use it, and off it goes. But even in Windows, once you've kind of made the initial decision, it's fairly painless. And when you need the backup, when you need to restore it, there it is.
It's one of those things. I mean, automated really is better, even though it's a bigger sunk cost up front. It just happens. The biggest thing is to check your backups. Like, actually pretend that everything crashed one time once you put in a new solution. And if you can't get your data back up, then you're wasting your time backing it up. You're not actually really backing it up.
Well, I had somebody contact me. I was using Acronis, for example. And Acronis, it doesn't back up your operating system. It doesn't back up your applications. All it does is it backs up your user files. It's designed to look in your user profile and back those things up. So if you were using any custom solutions, like creating a folder off the root drive,
It doesn't see it,
doesn't pick that stuff up. So some of the confusion when making backups is, first of all, how do I know I'm backing up what I need to back up? And then how do I restore it in the event of a disaster? So it does get, it's kind of, gives you a headache when you think about it too much. But you got to figure it. It's one of those things, like, you've decided you want to use a computer and you want to have a computer. You need to spend some time and learn about protecting your data if it matters to you. If it doesn't, fine. I mean, I've met people who say, I don't care, you know, whatever, just reload everything. You know, maybe, but, you know, figure it out. Something that's important. All right, Groovehouse, I see we have a call in the queue.
Yes.
Who is it?
All right, up next, we're going to take Mary.
Mary, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hi. You were talking about backing up with the Time Machine.
Yeah.
So I'm not as familiar with Mac, and it appears to me, can you tell me what it actually backs up? I don't think it backs up my email because I use Outlook.
It may.
It backs up anything that is on your hard drive that you have changed. When you initially set up Time Machine, it makes a complete image of what your hard drive currently looks like.
That would be everything. That would be your user profile, your applications, the operating system, the whole nine yards. It doesn't get granular at all. It just says, here's your whole hard drive, makes a copy of it.
Then every hour, it looks for changes to any files or any new files, and then it backs those up.
Or deleted files and removes them.
Right. And so it goes through over time, and it consolidates. So it'll take what you've done, all the stuff you did for a day, and puts it into a daily backup.
Right.
And in a week, it takes it and puts it in a week. So if it is a file written to your drive, it will find it and back it up. You can go in and tell it not to do specific place folders or specific files, but if you just leave it at the default, any file that's written to your hard drive, it'll back up. If you're using my Outlook and you're using it on an Exchange server where the mail it's on your local, then it is being backed up.
So it's grabbed the Outlook application, it's grabbed the PST file, it looks and sees every hour that PST file, if it's modified because new mail came in, it increments the backup and gets the new copy of it.
And how do I look to see see if I made any changes to that.
There's no need for you to look to see that. The software is designed to do that for you.
Although if you have, you would know it. If you have to kind of willfully go
settings. To the actual settings.
Right. You would go into the settings for Time Machine, and there's a thing that says, I don't back this up, and you would have to willfully do it. It's not something you could accidentally do.
Okay, and it's been a while since I set that up. I don't think I excluded anything.
But you can look at your Time Machine preferences and see what the settings are.
Right, just go into System Preferences and Time Machine, and it will, let's see if I can find the specific location. It's under Options, and it'll be Exclude These Items from Backup. So it's System Preferences, Time Machine, Options.
Okay, and does it back up what's on the desktop? It
backs up the entire hard drive.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Everything means everything.
Oh.
That's one of the beauties about Time Machine is Time Machine is designed to back up the entire hard drive so that if your system crashes, you just connect your Time Machine drive. There's a special way you boot the system, I guess, with the operating system disk.
Nope. You just plug it in.
It boots from the hard drive. It looks at the Time Machine backup, and it just takes all that data and puts it back on your computer once it's working properly, and you're right back where you left off.
Okay. For some reason, I thought that it didn't back up things that were not native Mac programs.
Oh, no, not at all.
No, that's not the case at all.
I'm glad to hear that.
All right.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for your call.
In fact, Time Machine has some APIs that developers can plug into. So, for example, in Parallels, if you don't want to back up those large virtual machines that might be created when you install Windows into Parallels, in Parallels, you can check "Don't back this up" in Time Machine.
Really?
And yes, and it will not do that. So I have mine set up to not back up, and I back those up manually on a separate drive because they're so big.
Yeah, and you just grab your VMs and just drag and drop.
Right.
All right. 713-526-5738. It's iffy whether we have time left or not.
We'll take this call.
And we're done?
Yes,
all right,
sir.
Forget it. Don't call. If you're dialing, just hang up. All right, who's up?
All right, last call on the show is going to be Chris.
Chris, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Yes, I have a question.
Turn your radio down.
I'm sorry? Hello?
Hello, is your radio turned up?
No, it's not.
Okay.
Yeah, my question is, I have a small business, and I wanted to block internet access to all sites except for, you know, just a select few sites that our company uses. Is there a software out there that I can put on my computer that I can just select which site that people can go into?
You're going to need a firewall router that allows you to put in access lists to be able to determine where people could go. It's not like a simple, easy piece
Unless
of software.
Everybody uses the same computer. There's one computer. Then you could put software on that computer.
Right. But you're talking about multiple computers all connected to your network at the office, which has access to the internet, right?
Yeah,
you're going to have to look at getting a router with a firewall, and then you're going to have to learn how to configure that firewall to do access lists and block everything except for... And you can set up an access list that basically blocks everything.com, everything.net, with exceptions for particular websites, but it'd be messy. But yeah, you could do it.
Okay, because we do have a router already. Just configure that router
if it does that,
you know, what kind of router do you have? I mean, if it's like a Linksys or a Netgear that's designed for home, it's not going to let you do that.
Although
parental access might let you do that on some of them.
Some keyword blockers and stuff
like that. Yeah, on the newer ones that have parental access, you could actually use that to do the same thing. But you started to say it sounded like you have a business class router.
Yes.
Well, do you know what it is?
It's a Linksys.
That's still kind of homish. That's still prosumer at most.
Prosumer at best. I'm thinking like a Cisco Pix or something like that.
Check in there. Just, you know, worst case, you can Google. You can get Netgear stuff for a couple hundred that'll do it, and you can get all the way up into, like, you know, Cisco Pix for several thousands, or even like Sonic Wall for a thousand. There's whatever you want to spend. You can.
But there's also this a giant learning curve. You're going to have somebody that knows how to configure that. It's not like, you know, where you run a Windows software and you run this program. Block internet access. Allow Google or whatever. Sure. It's not that easy to set up. But anyway, wish you a lot of luck. We're out of time. And, find yourself a firewall router admin. And that's what they pay them the big bucks for. Groovehouse will do it.
Either that or put up a real weak firewall, and the guy who gets through it, put him in charge of...
Run your own DNS and only put in the entries you want people to go to.
Just unplug everybody from the... Or just unplug,
turn off the internet.
Turn off the internet.
Local cache the site you want on your machine, and then, shut everyone else off.
Download the internet to a thumb drive. The part that you want. All right, well, we're out of time here on Technology Bites. We're really glad you tuned in. I don't even get to go home right after this either. Oh, crud. I'm going to go take a nap in my car. All right, so we'll see you next week after I've had my nappy nap. Thanks for tuning in. Stick around for Vegan World Radio coming your way here locally in Houston. Check your local listings if you're listening outside the Houston area. This is Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flipted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Dwight.
And he's...
Groovehouse.
Yay, Groovehouse.
I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host of the syndicated news program Uprising, and I'll be in Houston on Friday, April 13th, speaking at St. Paul's Methodist Church at 5501 South Main Street at 7 p.m. I'll be addressing topics of social justice, citizen journalism, and the budding human spring, the story of the phenomenal protest around the world, from the global Occupy movement to European austerity demonstrations to the regime-changing Arab Spring. You can also attend a meet-and-greet with me also at St. Paul's Methodist at 6 p.m. Advanced ticket purchases can be made online at kpft.org, and all proceeds go to award-winning listener-sponsored KPFT Radio. This is Sonali Kolhatkar, and again, I'll be in Houston speaking on Friday, April 13th at 7 p.m. at St. Paul's Methodist Church, 5501 South Main Street. This is KPFT Radio 90.1 FM, Houston, Galveston, Goodrich, Huntsville, and the world.
The Kima Crawfish Festival showcases the sights, the music, the great taste, and above all, the fun that is Kima, the gateway to the bay. This is the festival's second year, and this year there'll be more crawfish, crawfish races, crawfish eating contests, crabs, vendors in a children's area, more serving lines, more food vendors, more activities, and the area's best Zydeco bands providing infectious rhythm where the bayou meets the bay. And the Houston Blues Society will bring the blues to the bridge. If you buy your tickets in advance through kpfd.org, you'll get a discount too. Friday, April 13th through Sunday, April 15th, the Kima Crawfish Festival takes the friendly, relaxed, fun, and community atmosphere of a small town fair and, like the city of Kima, serves it up big.